ज्ञानत्रयं तस्य जनञ्जनशलाकया चाक्षुरं निलितं येन तस्मै श्रीगुरवे नमः हरि ओं तत्सत् ओम्
आह थैंक्स ब्रदर
Finally.
Finally. It's been years we've been talking about doing this.
Yes.
Here we are. Isn't it interesting when that happens?
Yes.
When there's like a lot of build up to something and then you get to the actual moment and it's like, okay, here's the moment. Like,
and it's so chill.
I wanted to ask you about authentic voice. I know you have an upcoming workshop. And part of what I saw there is, you know, like, discovering your authentic voice. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious, what does that mean to you?
This is my experience, and I think a lot of others' experiences, is children. Some people are not born with easy access to their voice. So they may be singing as a child and someone says, you know, you're singing off key or you're not singing in a beautiful way. And then we kind of just get shut down and think that, oh, well, I'm just not a singer. And then it all, I think most people still enjoy singing, but they do it alone and have judgment for themselves. And it's my firm belief that we're all inherently musical beings. It's a kind of an essential piece of our nature. So my goal was first just finding my own voice, just singing by myself. And then I had the profound experience as a young boy singing in church. And that amazing feeling that you get when you're not only singing by yourself, but you're singing with others. And you're singing about divine, conscious ideas. And to me, that was a life-changing moment. And what I find when I'm singing with others who are maybe new to singing or are not comfortable singing, that this experience of group singing is really healing. And so my goal is to just remind everyone that we're all musical beings, and that we all have the ability to make music and should do that for our own mental health and spiritual development.
Why do you think that healing occurs in those moments?
Well, I think there's the subtlety of just sound vibration is so powerful. You know, you're a lover of music. Most people are a lover of music. And music has the ability to change our consciousness, our state. So I think that's the most powerful thing is, one, we can absorb music in like a concert, but when we're actively participating in it, it's just very healing for the soul. I think it's in our DNA. When you look at all of these ancient cultures and ancient tribes, music is an essential piece, and it's everyone's participating. It's not, there's this one musician and we just sit around and listen to her all the time. It's a community building activity that I think our modern culture is kind of not cultivated that, but it's all within our DNA. So I mean, that's why I think it's so healing, because we've been doing it for millennia as a community.
Yeah. This to me is what's so special about kirtan. It's like the participatory aspect of it. You know, like we get together often here to have kirtan. And sometimes I think about, you know, wanting to play some songs that I enjoy playing there. But I realize in those moments that that's nice. But what happens at kirtan is another level because we're all participating. You know, and so I just consider that, like, we all want to be involved.
Yeah.
You know, and when that balance happens between the facilitator, the leader, and everyone, the audience, You know, actually, I thought there's a lot of things about like democratizing components of life. Mm-hmm. And I think there's like a fundamental philosophy here that people can have that either it's better if just one person does something, mm-hmm. or if we crowdsource and gather a little bit from everyone, or like the collective intelligence, that it's going to be at a higher level than the individual. And I'm not sure. I think that there's something to be said. But like as an example, even, you know, sometimes famous musicians will allow the audience to sing their songs that are so popular and everyone knows it, you know, and they'll stop singing. And all of a sudden you just hear the crowd singing together, you know, thousands of voices in harmony. And I just wonder about that. Like, will that one single musician, can that one single musician ever compare to thousands of voices singing together?
Yeah. I don't think so. I think it's a matter of sheer numbers and participation. You know, I think we as kirtan leaders, the goal of someone leading a kirtan is maximum participation from everyone that's there. So it's a very, it's all about inclusion, the practice of kirtan. I got a very beautiful lesson in kirtan early on. It was before I was ever really leading kirtan, and Durgadas, who's David Newman, was here doing kirtan college, and at that time I was administrating the program. And he told a very beautiful story that impacted me deeply, and it's something I share with anyone who is new in leading kirtan. So he was playing kirtan, he was playing guitar, and he was so into what he was doing. And when he ended the kirtan, in his mind, it was like, this was one of the best kirtans I've ever had. And he wanted to get a reflection from those who were there. And this beautiful soul raised their hand and said, you know, I can see that you had a really beautiful experience, but you didn't take us with you. Hmm. And of course, I'm sure for David Newman, that was hard to hear. But at the same time, it was a deep lesson for him and is now a deep lesson for anyone who comes in contact with that story, where it's great to sound good, it's great to have fun, it's actually important that the leader is having fun, but you have to bring everyone into that. It's like, for him, the train left the station and no one was on the train. So for me personally, when I'm sitting with a group chanting kirtan, my ultimate job is to make sure everyone is feeling comfortable and feeling included in the experience. And that's what finding your voice is all about, is creating a very safe, conducive space where there's no judgment. One, you're not judging yourself, but ultimately, of course, you're not judging anyone else. And that's why in these kirtans where we're passing who's leading the kirtan, when someone leads and maybe their voice is crackling or you can tell they're very nervous, after they're done leading, everyone will clap and cheer just to kind of encourage and to thank that person for having the courage to sing in a group setting, because it's not easy in the beginning. But I think that's what kirtan is all about, is making sure everyone feels safe to express. Mm. Yeah.
It's really interesting. So I think there's two sides to this, or it might be a place for some balance, because I can imagine if you're the leader and it's all about the experience that other people are having, then you might only get so far too.
Right.
Like allowing yourself to have a deep, genuine, authentic experience also carries everyone. But if that's all that you're concerned with, then I think the example that you're giving, like the train left the station and no one. But I would also be curious, like, to have heard from other people. Like, maybe that was the one woman's experience.
Yeah.
She didn't feel that way. But I don't know. I do sometimes think, like, if someone is really having a powerful, genuine experience, then there's something special in that. And I do have the opportunity to get something beneficial.
Certainly.
From that, like just any wonderful musicians that like when you go to a concert and you see them and they're just doing their thing and maybe they don't even think that you're there. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't matter, like, if what's they're producing is art that can be beneficial to me.
Still just, touch the soul.
Yeah.
Totally.
Kirtan, you know, for myself, something interesting happens where I notice myself fluctuate. Sometimes I'm in a state where I'm just taking it in, and I don't even have the ability to... Well, maybe I have the ability, but I don't want to sing.
Yeah.
Like, I'm in such a deep meditative place that it's just like, oh, I'm just being flooded by these sounds.
Totally.
And then I'll come out of that and I'll participate. And that's wonderful too. Mm-hmm. And both are great. And I love to have the freedom of kind of going back and forth.
Right.
That. Yeah.
Yeah, I think when I say max participation, it doesn't mean that you have to be singing at the top of your lungs. But kirtan, what we're doing is we're chanting the names of the divine. So when I say max participation, it's that anyone who is in the kirtan is present for the kirtan. Whether you're just sitting meditating on the sound vibrations, or you're silently dancing, or you're singing at the top of your lungs, all of these are ways to participate. But I think what makes a powerful experience for everyone is that when you're in the kirtan, you're in it. How you're participating is totally up to you, and I think that's the beautiful kind of safe vibration that we can create, that there aren't really many rules. There are definitely structure to kirtan, which helps kind of be conducive for the experience, but... Yeah, there aren't any exact rules. Now, if you're in the back of the room talking on your cell phone, you're not participating. So it's one, respecting that sanctified place where we're all coming together to chant the names of the divine and hold that loving vibration in our hearts. So that's what I mean by mass.
Is that what you experience, like this loving vibration in your heart, and it like caught you and grabbed you and... you developed interest in going back there again and again.
Yeah. That's it. It's just being with your brothers and sisters and having this communal experience of music and the divine name and love for one another and love for life itself.
Love for life itself. Mm-hmm. That's not always an easy one, right?
No.
Is that how you feel genuinely, that you love this experience of being alive, or is it a journey? Do you notice yourself fluctuating, and is it a discipline to come back to that place, that perspective?
Yes, it's everything. You know, we do need to develop love and respect for this opportunity we've been given to be in a body and live on planet Earth, and know that it's structured in a way that it is not easy, and it's not supposed to be easy. But I think developing love and respect for the difficult pieces in our life are ultimately just the divine's way of teaching us. And it's approaching it with that attitude that everything that is happening to me is the divine grace, especially the difficult moments of life. Because these difficulties push us back to our source. You know, prayer really happens on a sincere level when there's something very difficult happening within your life. That's my experience, at least, is when my prayer is totally pure and totally surrendered and without ego is when something difficult is happening.
And that difficulty brings about this flavor of prayer that doesn't arise any other way?
Maybe not any other way. But I think that's when a lot of humans feel the need to connect to the divine. Because you feel the need, I'm surrendered. I need help. I need guidance. I need support. But then there's the practice of gratitude, which we've talked about a lot, which is, you know, equally powerful. Seeing how so many beautiful gifts that we're being given on a moment-to-moment basis and really being grateful for that.
I wonder if there's like a message. Maybe it's ridiculous to think about it like this, but I still wonder if there's like a, if there's a message that God is trying to send to us, or even like if God is learning through us. Mm. Like, as far as I can tell, like if we're generalizing, throughout time, more comforts and in ease of life, more pleasure is being offered to humans throughout the layers of time. Like just to think about our grandparents and compare my life to my grandparents' life, it's fundamentally so much easier because of technological advances and all of that. So, So I wonder, you know, it is like God thinking, this is ridiculous, that like, I'll just keep giving more. It's almost like you could do that for someone else, like even like a child. You can have that perspective for a child. Like, I'm just going to keep giving you because why wouldn't I give you like everything that I can offer you? I'm just going to keep giving it to you. And maybe what's being like realized potentially that the gratitude component has to be there, that the giving, everything that you can have is in a way worthless or not as valuable if the gratitude for it doesn't exist.
Totally. Totally. Yeah, and our modern society has given us a lot of gifts. But I personally seeing a trend of trying to simplify one's life. Our modern society, as humans, I don't think we're really built for what's going on. The amount of input from the outer world, cell phones, mass communications, these are all very beautiful gifts. And at the same time, I mean, you and I, we live at an ashram, so we're in the middle of the woods, 20 minutes from any gas station and grocery store. And a lot of our guests are coming from DC area cities, and they're coming because they need simplicity and they need nature and they need regimented spiritual practice. So I do believe the experience that one has in an ashram is kind of an antidote to modern society.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think it's such an antidote because it gives the space, it offers the space to come to conclusions on your own.
Yeah.
And I don't know about you, but like we're both dads, and you know, if I could say through this experience of being a father, I think the most important thing that I'm doing that I can do is to offer space.
Yeah.
You know, because most of the experience I had in my life was kind of lessons being forced onto me.
Yeah.
And that came from a good place.
Of course.
Like there were adults, older people in my life that had discovered these things and were trying to say like, Avi, this is how it is. Like, do this. But that didn't work. And I have that impulse too. Like, Zen, I'm going to teach you this lesson. Like, you know, I do it sometimes. But ultimately, like, I guess the great question for me is, can I really believe in the power of allowing her to discover on her own? And that she will, the conclusions she can come to on her own, like, I could have more faith in that than in any lesson I'm trying to teach her myself.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's what happens at the ashram, I think.
Totally. And I, you know, it's my firm belief that we as parents, our main job is to create a beautiful environment in the home that has boundaries. Boundaries are, of course, essential. Children need structure, need boundaries, but our ultimate goal is to create space for this soul to flower, and not flower how we think it should. You know, every individual is born with their own propensities and their own abilities, and you know, my goal as a father is to leave space for these children to flower into their ultimate true nature, not impose my own BS that has worked for me and also not worked for me. So, and of course, it's a razor's edge to walk as parents. But yeah, I think you and I, we're holding the same vibration in our hearts of just creating enough space and a very safe environment where these children can learn life's lessons, because it's all there. You know, it's built into the structure of human life to learn these very deep morals. It can be learned by just living, but it's important that we create boundaries and openness in the home.
And it's not isolation either.
No.
Like, it doesn't exist in, because, you know, speaking about this flowering, I don't think that ends. Like, that's still happening for you and me too.
Totally.
So we're holding the space, but we're also holding the space for ourselves to do. And we're kind of, these flowers are like bouncing around with each other.
Totally. I think by creating that space, it's healing for us too, to continue our journey of self-realization.
Yeah.
Yeah. But hopefully what we're doing for our children is we're empowering them to kind of already create the habit of getting to know oneself right from the beginning. You know, I think you and I, later in life, we kind of started that process over again. I know personally, I certainly did. Of, you know, high school is a very distracting place with many different emotions happening. And, you know, for me, after leaving high school and going to college and being on my own and having deep experiences, you know, that process kind of started to happen again, and it's still unfolding. And hopefully will be unfolding until we leave this earth.
So you don't have like an ambition that there's like a, there's an end point within being alive where there isn't any more learning?
No, I think it's infinite.
Yeah, that's my experience too. And I'm okay with that. Like, do you feel like you're okay with that? Like, that there isn't an end to it?
Well, one, we don't have an option, so might as well be okay with it. No, not always, but yeah, it is the human experience. So don't push back, don't fight it, lean into it.
Yeah. Yeah, there's something very supportive for me in that if it's true, even if it's difficult, I can deal with it.
Right.
Right. It's reality. This is the reality. As far as I can tell, if my heart says this is the situation, right, and I'm clear on that, then okay. But if it's all vague, then that's much harder.
Totally. Yeah. We're truth-seeking beings at our core.
And that doesn't end.
No. No end in sight.
Yeah. How do you practice authenticity? moment to moment.
Mm. For me, I use my heart as kind of a barometer. And I don't mean my physical heart, but my spiritual heart. So I notice interacting with the world, sometimes my heart closes, pushes away. And to me, that's kind of my own internal barometer of whether I'm being authentic or not. If I feel my heart closes off to others or to myself, it's kind of like a warning sign that I'm not in my own truth. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think so. But do you notice that there are times when you're listening more closely and then maybe you catch yourself like, wow, I wasn't tuned into that space. I was somewhere else.
Totally. Yeah, I think that's the modern human condition, and that's why meditation is such an important practice, because what we're doing is, one, we're closing off the outer world, and then we're going into ourself. And this practice of meditation, you know, we teach it here all the time. Meditation actually starts after you get off of your seat for meditation. It's like this formal 30 minutes to an hour practice is preparation. Because the goal is that we're living our entire day in this state of meditation, in this state of awareness and openness and in touch with ourself. So, I mean, if you've been to the ashram, you've probably heard this before, that, you know, the game really begins when you leave the meditation hall. Can you hold on to that awareness of yourself and of others and how you're interacting with the world?
I feel like something needs to be discovered or is discovered in order to do that.
Mm.
So meditation can be a place where what you're saying is discovered. It's right. Not necessarily the case. That doesn't have to happen, but it can happen. I'm curious, like, what is it that's discovered that allows for, in a way, it's a commitment to practicing this all the time.
Mm. To me, that discovery is ourself, our true nature. It's that we are souls on this very short journey on earth, and that every opportunity is an opportunity to love and to love oneself. And once we learn to love ourself, we can really learn to love others. But yeah, I think if there is something to discover, it's love. With a capital L.
How good that feels to be in that state.
Mm-hmm.
And it comes from this security, I think, also, or some kind of stability in the way that each of us are created.
Mm.
Like it's like honoring this being. Through honoring this being, like, deeply, genuinely, it can allow for that.
Mm. Yeah, to me, it's almost a state of fearlessness. Mm. What I've noticed is when we're afraid is when we close. And the state of fearlessness is a very powerful place to be. And I think it's, you know, in this world, there's so many things to fear. But when we realize our immortal nature and our total connection with every living thing on this planet, we learn that there's actually nothing to be afraid of. This is only a game which is driving us to realize our true nature, which is a state of fearlessness.
Yeah. What's really important to me is this is allegiance. I bring in this word.
Mm.
It's like I'm so grateful for this discovery, actually. I didn't realize that this is what was happening. And I think it's maybe happening for all of us, but I think it's a very powerful inquiry. Where is my allegiance?
Mm.
It's like what I hear you describing is an allegiance to love, right? Through the discovery of what that feels like. And so therefore, when fear arises, in those moments where fear comes up and it can be so strong, you know, there's a remembrance through what's practiced in meditation, right? Like that's the practice room, the training room, as you said, because fear will come up there too. Like if you wait long enough, you know, there will be the freer. No one else needs to be a part of it. You know, the fear will come. And in that, if I'm practicing in those moments, I mean, what is happening there? So let's just take meditation, meditating, and then fear comes up, whatever the flavor of fear is. And I can get stuck on it. I can be with that for the rest of the time until something else comes that I don't even notice. Or right away, I can pay attention. I'm paying attention. You know, or like that's even the allegiance to paying attention. My allegiance is just to pay attention.
Yeah.
And then through that, I notice, okay, the fear is here.
Right.
And then now what?
Right. I mean, I love the quote, the only way out is through. You know, when fear comes up, if it's, you know, in meditation, things are coming up. We call from the chittam, which is like the storehouse of emotions and thoughts. Things are boiling up. If they're just pushed back down, it's just going to come back up again. So to me, the process of meditation is letting those things flow through, seeing them clearly for what they are, which for the most part is misunderstanding, and letting that happen. And I think that's the essential piece of meditation is allowing and not judging. And then, of course, bringing the mind back to whatever your source of concentration is, be it mantra or affirmation or like Vipassana practice, which is just focusing on the breath or nothingness.
So the allowance, allows for returning to an intention, an area of focus. But what you're saying is that the first step is the allowance that there's nothing wrong, that this is okay. Is that, and then that opens up and allows for something to shift?
Yeah. I mean, Avi, you and I are both firm believers in cold therapy. And, you know, I recommend to pretty much everyone that I come across to practice cold therapy, be it cold showers or the ultimate is, you know, immersing yourself in cold water. But for me, why that practice is so powerful is because, one, you're looking at this tub of cold water and your mind is saying, I don't want to do this. And then you get in and physiologically your body's saying, I don't like this. I need to get out. But there's the intellect, the awareness, which is, no, I'm actually okay. I'm not dying, even though my brain and body are saying you are dying. But it's this practice of I'm okay. I'm not dying. And I'm in control of my own physiological responses to stress, be it cold, be it stress out in the world. So for me, my daily cold practice is just reminding myself that I'm okay. Yes, this is an intense experience, but I'm okay, and I can hold space for that. So for me, it's changed my life because, you know, living our daily lives, there are difficult experiences that we encounter. And difficult chemicals are produced in the body where it's uncomfortable. But it's not something we have to run away from. Actually, we can kind of lean into that discomfort and gain so much power and fearlessness from it.
Yeah.
Leaning into discomfort is not easy.
No, it's so interesting that like that's a way.
Yeah.
Like why is it set up like that? Why is that how it works?
I don't know. I mean, if you think of, say, the practice of Vipassana, where for 10 days you're sitting and that is all you're doing, and the many processes that you go through in your mind where, what are you doing? This is ridiculous. Your knees feel like they're exploding. Your back is hurting. Why are you doing this? Yet these powerful yogis, which I've never done Vipassana, but I've sat enough to know kind of the gravity of that practice. And it's so powerful to kind of sit through that and then see what's on the other side. Just like in the cold plunge, when you're sitting there, what's on the other side of that discomfort is bliss.
And yeah, am I able to go through that discomfort to get to the bliss?
Mm-hmm.
That's what it's about.
Mm-hmm. And it's knowing in your heart that the bliss is always there.
But we can do things that help us remember.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's what the practice of yoga is.
Yeah. At the end of my cold plunges, I go under and hold my breath. And those moments are the ones where I really come up face to face with fear the most.
Yeah.
And it's crazy. Like, it's really intense because like I feel death there when I'm holding my breath and I'm holding my breath and I'm relaxing and I'm allowing and I'm being successful at that. It's all okay until it's not, you know, until it's like, no, there's a problem. Like, you need to breathe. And then that's okay too. That's okay too.
Wow.
And then the same thing again. And then, okay. Mm-hmm. Like, eventually I'm going to have to come up and breathe, and that's fine. But there's something in that whole process. Like, when I go through that a few times and the fear comes up again and it's a little bit stronger and deeper and I allow it, and that it feels like it's beneficial for me to be doing
Certainly. Yeah. It's just, we're exercising the muscle of the willpower and just being okay with fear and comfort. Yeah.
And I wonder if all that is like preparation for what we're encountering in our daily lives, which is, you know, it's a combination. It's not just the hard stuff. But there's the hard stuff. And I don't know about you, but it's like, I find other people can be the most challenging part, like in a way, like all those practices are tools to help, because I feel so helpless sometimes in regard to other people. Like I can feel where they're at and I want to help them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I'm curious what your take is on this, but life has told me from trying to help so many different times that I need to allow for other people to discover things in their own time. And it's back to being a dad, but in a way, the same thing happens often just with interactions with other adults, where I feel like I see something, I notice something that could be beneficial to someone else, but I don't feel like there's a real way to offer them what I have to offer them that's going to be productive.
Yeah.
So I just need to, okay, let go. Like, that's what God has taught me. It's just like, I got this, Avi. Like, you don't need to fix this.
Right. And Swami Satchidananda always says, you have to become a seeker, you have to become a sicker. So if someone's not ready to start a practice or, you know, make a shift in their life, it's not up to us to convince them that it's the right thing to do. It's something we all have to come to on our own terms, for sure. But it's hard because we know things work. They've worked for us, and most likely they'll work for others, not always. But until someone's ready in their own heart, there's nothing we can do other than just make space. And that's what we're talking about, is this space.
Yeah. And to prepare myself for the times that might come where someone does ask, where things open up.
Right.
Because there's all the difference there of trying to like either force something onto someone else or just being here. And if someone wants to come and ask and say, okay, you know, I'm having this issue or whatever it is.
Right.
Then they're receptive.
Totally.
To it. But the timing is everything.
Timing is everything. Patience is everything. You know, especially when this person is someone you love deeply, you know, it's easier for you to want to be very proactive, but we can't force these things. Mm. Yeah.
I want to go back to authentic voice, and if you could share about like your experience a little bit more and like what happened to you in terms of your relationship with your own voice and finding kirtan. What that journey's been like.
Mm. So the journey for me, well, I've always loved music. You know, when I was 2, 3, and 4, the only way I would fall asleep is by listening to my favorite albums. I don't even remember what they were, but of course my parents remember because they played them all the time. So there was that, and my first experience of congregational singing was in church. You know, I grew up in a moderately religious family, and we went to church every Sunday. And as a kid, sermons were pretty boring. But before the sermons, for the first 30 minutes, we would sing. So I grew up next to my father, who is a wonderful musician, a beautiful singer. Singing with him, you know, I was next to him, but we're singing as a congregation, and there was just a feeling that would well up in my heart of just love and joy. And also singing next to my father, who was a beautiful singer, and he would harmonize, you know, with the music. And that's also where I learned, you know, the science of harmonizing. So that was, I guess, my first powerful experience. And, you know, as I grew up, I got less interested in church. I had the blessing in high school. I was very into basketball. And playing junior varsity, I blew out my knee, which I was so disappointed. I thought I was just going to play basketball all high school. But with this injury, I needed to find something else to do. So I joined choir. And one, that was an emotionally hard thing to do. I went to private school and then went to public school in high school. So I, you know, entered high school with a couple friends, but not many friends. And of course, there's some judgment around cliques. And if you're into sports or if you're into theater, if you're into choir, if you're into band. But for me, you know, choir was a very healing experience. And that's where I definitely started to discover my own voice. And my choir teacher was an amazing soul. And she forced me to do solos, which if anyone's encountered singing alone in front of a group of people, it's terrifying. And was and still is terrifying sometimes. But choir was a very beautiful experience for me, but it ended when I left high school. You know, I got together with a dear friend, Ryan, and we played music all the time, and that was so beautiful, but it was just me and him. And it wasn't until I came to the ashram in 2014, and my teacher, Satya Greenstone, the first thing we did before saying anything was we chanted together, kirtan. And it was my first time I had ever even encountered this practice, which to me, you know, brought me right back to my roots. But it was even more humble somehow, this practice of kirtan. And that's really what lit the fire, is how good it feels to sing congregationally with one, people you don't even know, and also people that you love. And it kind of just dissolves the boundaries. So for me, it was that. And then, you know, the way to find your voice is to use your voice. Mm. And to learn to not judge yourself, and especially not to judge others. But the only way you cannot judge others is by learning to not judge yourself. As Swami Satchidananda says, everything begins at home. And until we establish whatever it is in our own heart, we can't expect to be able to manifest that in the outer world. It's just not possible.
It seems that maybe there's a fine line between judgment and maybe call it discernment or something, because like, let's say as I'm singing, right, as you're singing, you notice there was a moment maybe where it didn't sound the way you wanted it to sound, or something happened, mm-hmm. right? So it's like almost like there's a judgment there mm-hmm. of that moment, but maybe it doesn't have to be judgment in that way. It's more of just discernment, opportunity to learn something, because that's how improvement happens, by paying attention.
Totally.
But you could also almost say that, like, paying attention is being judgmental. So it's like really kind of hard to unpack that, right? What's happening there?
Yeah, I think it's discernment. And you're realizing, okay, when I sing this, my voice cracks, or I'm singing a little off key. That's certainly important. And if one wants to develop themselves, then there are pathways to do that. You know, after the pandemic, kirtan got very popular at the ashram. And I think the main reason it did is because during the pandemic, we were all alone and separated and socially maybe not even like allowed to come together in big groups. So kirtan's being such a beautiful communal practice, you know, it really took off after the pandemic. But for me personally, because we are practicing kirtan and we love it, it's very important that we look at the roots of these traditions and not only look at them, but respect them and practice them. So that's why I've started teaching this weekly class at the ashram, Yoga of the Voice, because there are ancient thousands and thousands of year old traditions of music of the East where there are very scientific practices to where we can, one, develop our voice, develop our ear for music, which ultimately just makes for a better experience in kirtan, because you're increasing your ability. It's not just chanting kirtan, it's practicing scales, learning ragas, learning how to pronounce Sanskrit in a very respectful way, so that we're respecting these ancient traditions that are, you know, giving us so much joy. So to me, yeah, one, not judging, but I think when we judge, we kind of, our heart closes. But discrimination and discernment, which I think is what you're talking about, is very important. Because, yeah, we can refine our voice, we can refine our musical abilities, and everyone can do so. It's not just some people are gifted, some are not, therefore you're not, you know, it's not worth putting the work in. It's always worth it.
I wonder if it's like there can be like a foundation of acceptance.
Yeah.
And that's like, that's the stability there.
Right.
Both for myself and others. It's like, yes, of course I accept you. Like, of course I think that you're a divine being. That, you know, that I believe in your genuine self. Of course that I love you. And when that's stabilized, now we can play on top of it.
Right.
But I think what can happen with judgment often that we notice is that judgments can sever the foundation themselves.
Yeah.
You know, and we forget this stability.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like judgment severs trust. And when we're chanting congregationally, trust is essential. Trust that I'm not going to be judged if my voice cracks or if I sing off key. That I'm just going to be encouraged because I had the bravery to try. Yeah.
Yet I've also seen people come in to kirtan settings and try to shift it towards something else or grab, you know, the attention on themselves. And I've witnessed the leader of the kirtan very artfully redirecting that person or making it clear that that's not what we're doing, you know, right now. So again, totally. It's like an art to be able to navigate these things.
Totally. Totally. I've been really enjoying going to old time jams recently. And for anyone who doesn't know, you know, old time music is kind of the roots of what we call bluegrass now. And old time music is just like kirtan. You know, when I was a young boy going to play with my cousin at my aunt and uncle's house, they would have, this is in Floyd County, which is a very rural place. You know, friends from the county, you know, you could know there's an old time jam at someone's house because all of the furniture is moved out into the yard so that the living room has space and everyone sits in a circle typically, and there are different instruments. Some are singing, some are playing instruments, some are just listening. And there are tunes that are just well known, and, you know, they go around in the circle and each one leads their own tune. And I've been to jams locally here where, you know, a hotshot will come in and try to kind of like make it all about themselves. And the elders who are there are kind of there to protect everyone and to also make sure that no one's, you know, stealing the stage, that it's this communal experience and everyone are equals. Whether you're like an amazing touring musician making $1 million a year, when you enter that circle, everyone is equal. And, you know, that's a folk tradition. Kirtan is a folk tradition. And these folk traditions, be it, you know, one's from the West, one is from the East, you know, the vibration is the same, that we're all coming here community as community, and we're all equals and participating in that way.
You mentioned before kind of this belief that you have that that we all have a musical inclination. I remember exactly how you put it, right? That we all have this, you know. And so would you also say that inside all of us is a beautiful voice? Because, you know, you often hear like the label, like, oh, I just have a horrible voice, or you don't want to hear me sing, something like that. Like when you hear someone say that, do you consider like, that's what you think, but that's not the truth.
Yeah, I mean, it is totally true that some are born naturally with the ability to sing and to hear tone and to sing in key. But it is my firm belief that wherever you're coming from, that refinement is always possible. For some people, it may mean more work. But to me, it's always possible. And what's important is maybe you actually don't want to sing, but there's still music inside. Singing is not the only way to express musically. There's percussion, there's learning instruments. So it doesn't always have to be singing in order to cultivate your musical nature. It's much bigger than that.
What caused you to decide to take this leap and now, you know, offer this workshop?
Mainly just people coming and asking me to teach them things. You know, I'm no expert in anything, certainly not music. But I know enough to where people come and they ask for me to show them things. So that has been happening a lot the past 3 years, and I've been doing things one-on-one, and just thought, why not start to share this in a more broad way? If this is how I can serve, which, you know, if people are coming to me and asking, I just see it as the divine's asking, this is what I need you to do, so do it. So yeah, it took a leap of faith, and, you know, there's always imposter syndrome, which comes in of like, who are you to say that I'm going to teach this class? But that's just the judgment coming in, where if people are showing up and there are smiles on their face and they're enjoying what's happening, then I'm just here to serve. You know, the day when no one shows up will be the day it stops, you know? But really just trying to take the guidance of the divine.
Is this important to you, to be like listening to what is showing up? Kind of like the universe is having a conversation with you. Mm-hmm. And, oh, if this is what people are asking for, I'm going to listen and I'm going to do it. Like, do you find that you're having this ongoing relationship with what's happening in the external world? And maybe are you getting more adept at listening to what's showing up? Not kind of fighting against it, but welcoming it?
Totally. Yeah, surrender is my main practice, and it is, you know, true surrender is no joke. It's not easy. But I've spent a lot of my life trying to control my outside environment so that I can feel more comfortable. And every time I try to manipulate the outer environment so that I can feel more comfortable, it never seems to work. So, I mean, my main focus right now is what I can do is manipulate my inner environment. Manipulating the outer environment is fraught in failure. But if I can manipulate my inner environment to where I'm okay in whatever situation life presents to me that's the ultimate power of the human being, is to be so deeply rooted in your own peace that you know everything's okay. But rooting yourself in that peace is also listening to your heart and also listening to the world of like, what is actually being asked of me? Opposed to what am I asking of the world so that I can be a happy, comfortable person. It's really, I think we're all here to discover how we can serve one another. I think that's the ultimate experience of community, is here are my abilities How can I use my abilities to serve others?
And that awareness or that ability is a byproduct of all the management of what's happening internally.
Totally. Yeah.
It's very practical, too, I think, to focus on this. It's like the most practical thing in the world.
Yeah.
Because I have direct control.
Exactly. It's the only thing we have direct control over is ourself. But it takes exercise, right?
Yeah, and it seems that that's the place maybe where fear lives.
Of course.
The most. And in the world we're living in today, it's easier than ever to practice avoidance because there's so many shiny objects to distract yourself with.
Totally. Totally.
Thanks so much, brother.
Yeah.
I'm really grateful that you're here.
I'm honored to be here.
Would you be up for ending us with a chant, please?
Yeah. Om Satoma Satgamaya Tamasoma Jyotirgamaya Mrityorma Amritam Gamaya Om Shanti 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 Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Hari Om Tat Sat.
Thanks for listening. If you've enjoyed this content and think others might as well, please feel free to share and subscribe.